All right, everyone. Welcome to this very, very special roundtable which we're going to have today. We're going to discuss whistleblowing, and especially digital whistleblowing, with an excellent panel of people today. So I want to start off with telling why this is such an important topic and why we are discussing this. So it's all about the whistleblowers, right? So we have like a bunch of whistleblowers, and one of them is Thomas Drake, who is right here on this panel, who is a former national security whistleblower who exposed quite a bit of wrongdoing in the NSA, the Thin Threat program, if I'm right. Yeah. Yeah. And a lot more. All right. And next to that, we have Bradley Manning. And this is more and more relevant because Bradley Manning's verdict came in like last week. He isn't sentenced yet, right? To, no. All right. I should actually like talk in this microphone. So this is important. Next to that, we have Edward Snowden, who today got released on the Moscow airport, and he just actually left. So yeah, yeah. Right on. So this is why this is relevant, and we need to have a discussion, because there are quite a lot of challenges which we are facing, not only on a legal perspective, or not only the whistleblowers, it's much and much larger. And a few of those are in publishing. When do you publish? Like, is there self-censorship needed? And why do certain media outlets censor, like The Guardian? Is it because they are afraid, or is it because they don't grasp the entire information which you are publishing? Next to that, we have the whistleblowers and what kind of like challenges the whistleblowers face. They get prosecuted, they get harassed, they are under an enormous amount of pressure. And how can we solve this, and how can we change their situation and turn it into something better? Next to that, we have the journalists who are often harassed, like Glenn Greenwald, who is being harassed, and even people next to him, even his family or his partner, whose laptop got stolen in Brazil and broken into. So there's quite a few, there's quite a bit of harassment. Next to that, we have the legal perspective which we would really like to discuss, because as we all know, WikiLeaks is being investigated into a secret court in a grand jury investigation in Virginia. And next to that, we have someone on the panel who his information got subpoenaed in the WikiLeaks grand jury case. Yeah. So this is all relevant. Next to that, we have the technical challenges. Is digital whistleblowing still like a good thing to do, or is it even like a safe thing to do? Because Edward Snowden has told us, and Thomas Drake has told us, that the internet is in a massive amount of surveillance. So is it actually safe, or should we go back to sending like brown envelopes to press agencies? It's something to discuss. Next to that, there's how do you create social impact? This is relevant to publishing and then on an editorial level. Do you, like WikiLeaks, do you just gonna publish it, and then some other people are gonna write the stories about it? Or are you gonna partner with media cooperations and the mass media, like The Guardian, The Spiegel, these kind of outlets? And next to that, yeah, the editorial stuff. So it's gonna be interactive, so the audience can ask questions as well. And maybe it's a good thing first to hand the microphone to Celia Dreyfus, and that the entire panel is gonna introduce themselves.
Hello, good afternoon, everybody. I hope you're not feeling too much like a melted ice cream cone in here yet. My name is Dr. Sulet Dreyfus. I'm a research fellow at the University of Melbourne in the Department of Computing and Information Systems. I do research into the impact of digital technology on whistleblowing and public attitudes to whistleblowing, as well as in the e-health and e-education areas. My background is as a professional journalist, so I worked as a staff reporter on Australia's largest selling newspaper, and I wrote a book way back in 1997, when I must have been only seven, with Julian Assange, called Underground, which documented a set of early hacker cases in the US, Europe, and Australia, and has obviously been made into a film and translated into 7 languages. There are a few copies of Underground, hard copies, dead tree copies, actually, for sale in the back if anyone's interested.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Arturo Filastò, and I'm a developer at the Tor Project, where I work on network censorship-related things, and I am one of the developers of GlobalLeaks, which is an open-source free software whistleblowing platform to allow organizations that are interested in running such an initiative to do so, hopefully securely. So our hope here is that the answer to the question, is it technically feasible, is it secure to do whistleblowing over the internet, we hope to be able to answer yes, and not have to rely on brown envelopes.
Hi, I'm Jesselyn Radek. I'm a whistleblower myself, and right now I work at the Government Accountability Project. I'm the National Security and Human Rights Director. We represent whistleblowers, which normally means representing people who are about to lose their jobs or got demoted or had their security clearance pulled. But unfortunately, under President Obama, my job has entailed representing a number of people, including Tom Drake, who are being prosecuted under the Espionage Act for, quote, leaking, when in reality they were blowing the whistle.
Thomas Drake, NSA whistleblower, a former senior executive in the U.S. government, and I sit before you as a free human being. And I've dedicated the rest of my life, given the ordeal I went through for the 5 years on the short end of a blunt instrument of the U.S. government, defending life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Hi, I'm Sumar McCarthy. I'm traditionally a software developer, but got pulled into a lot of whistleblowing-related issues back in 2009, 2010. But for the last 3 years, I've been working more on the legal side of things, trying to figure out if we can bring about good legal environments to protect whistleblowers around the world. So far, not going all that well, but you know, we've got time.
Pedro, originally I'm a philosopher. I've been since 2010 like reporting both on whistleblowing and materials leaked by whistleblowers. Now we are running a media agency, which is called Associated Whistleblowing Press, which somehow try to learn from the faults of a centralized whistleblowing system. So we somehow promote an alternative to current whistleblowing media agencies.
All right, thank you. So I guess we would like to start, and I guess I'm gonna sort of like lead this discussion and the questions. So let's start off first with a question to the panel, and we would like to answer that. Please go ahead. So we have had Edward Snowden, who have leaked this information, and there's a lot to tell, and not only because of the material, but also about how the media has handled this information. So it's about whistleblowing and it's about publishing. What challenges do we face there, and how can we, and what do we see, and what's going wrong, and how could we improve them and have better impact on this?
I think the digital era and the options open up new possibilities for whistleblowing that we could never imagine. Normally, the first thing I would say is please consult a lawyer or a journalist or both before you do this on your own, because the worst thing is to become an accidental whistleblower when you weren't meaning to do it. But I believe an entire new frontier has been opened up because of groups like WikiLeaks and because of things like Tor. And for example, the New Yorker magazine has created a drop box for people to give tips and leads and blow the whistle. these are relatively new in formation and they're in their infancy. So I don't know how well they work yet. I know in general, whether it is WikiLeaks or the Dropbox, those communications are more secure, I'm thinking, on the receiving end. I'm quite confident the WikiLeaks, they are secure on their receiving end. It is on the sending end where people might get caught and need to be careful. But I really think right now, in terms of what Bradley Manning did and what Edward Snowden did, they are whistleblowers. A whistleblower is someone who reveals fraud, waste, abuse, illegality, or danger to public health and safety. Usually, these folks work for the government or used to. I think, obviously, there are all sorts of new things you can capitalize on with digital whistleblowing. But again, I rely and I urge all of you to rely on the most secure encryption you can find, because again, you're more likely to be caught on your end rather than on the end of the recipient.
Yeah, no, I definitely share some of what Jaislyn is saying, and I agree that this kind of issue is something that needs to be dealt with on two different sides. You know, there is one side which is the technical side and how, you know, we should be advising to use the most secure software, rely on encryption, et cetera, but it's also clearly an issue also from a perspective of law and policy, because the fact that it is even possible to harass and prosecute whistleblowers like they are harassing and prosecuting whistleblowers like Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden and Thomas Drake, then there is something wrong there that needs to be fixed. And it's not out of chance that, for example, the Hermes Center, the nonprofit organization that we have founded in Italy, that deals with these kinds of topics, is formed of you know, sort of equal parts technical people, hackers, but also lawyers, people that understand law and are able therefore to understand this better from that point of view. And so, yeah, it's generally more the case that it is a problem on the sending side, because on the receiving side you have somebody that has some technical skill and some understanding. So it's really a matter of being able to balance and find the right level of security and usability for the user.
I would just say it's wonderful. I'm so glad to hear that journalists and lawyers are working together, because there's not a lot of cooperation there in the United States. But the state of the law for whistleblowers in the United States is atrocious. If you are a national security or intelligence employee, in other words, the kinds of people like Tom Drake, Bradley Manning, Edward Snowden, who are being prosecuted under the Espionage Act, you have no whistleblower protection whatsoever. We worked 12 years and finally got a Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act this year, and then Obama negated the entire thing by issuing a brief saying that anything deemed national security sensitive would have no protection. And in America, pretty much, you give me, say any word, and I can make it national security related. Dirty diapers? I can make that related to national security. I'm not going to up here, but unfortunately, the state of protection for whistleblowers in the US is at an all-time low.
The only thing I'll say, as a whistleblower, you're extraordinarily exposed within the system, and in particular when you decide to go outside the system. And the fundamental question becomes, in terms of digital whistleblowing, who do you trust? Not just the trusting of a system or trusting of encryption, but it's also who do you trust in terms of who are you sharing the information with. I had to spend many, many months determining the best mechanisms that were available at the time under the circumstances in which I found myself when I decided to make that fateful decision after having blown the whistle for many years within the system to make the decision to go to a reporter. But the reporter didn't know who I was. I couldn't just show up at their doorstep in downtown DC because there's all kinds of cameras and the security guard, you have to sign in to go upstairs to their office. So what do you do? I went digital. And I was digital and anonymous for about a year before I ended up meeting the reporter, and finally she knew who I was. But there's still a fundamental issue of who do you trust and what do you trust and what are the best means by which you can actually disclose, whether it's anonymous or not. It's extraordinarily fraught with peril. And the technical side, although it is an issue, in many respects, the social side of this is far more complex. Just because there's a site out there that says they accept submissions from whistleblowers / leakers, okay, doesn't mean it's necessarily secure. And I can speak from very personal experience that some people in this audience and beyond are well aware of. Just because you use a particular encryption mechanism does not guarantee you're anonymous. There's still, on the internet, you still have to get the information, the message to the recipient. And so there's some fundamental weaknesses on the sending end, and especially when you may have already been flagged or you're being followed electronically by the government suspecting that you're engaging in release of sensitive or perhaps even allegedly classified information.
So the way I'd like to think about this is that up until about 2010, whistleblowing was essentially a craft industry in the sense that it was something that was done very specifically on very specific files with a clear objective, and you know it was a very kind of individualized process. Post Bradley Manning's exposures, what we've been seeing increasingly is a kind of industrial version of whistleblowing, in the sense that now larger files, larger caches of files, sometimes much more complicated, telling many more stories, essentially just a much more complicated version of the same thing is coming out in increasing rate. And this basically leads us to this weird problem of having to rely much more heavily on the analytical capacity of journalists to actually sift through it, figure out what's actually relevant, and you know, deal with all of the data. So one of the challenges we're going to have to deal with is the fact that journalism as a concept is more or less burned out. The old model was the press were responsible for gathering the information and putting it in one place and making it available to people. But now everybody can do that. That's what we call Twitter or whatever now. On the other hand, the investigative part, the part that actually requires real journalistic efforts, and which is essentially the same part as does the analysis of these files, that has probably never been as poorly funded. The people doing that kind of work are very much at risk in the exact same way as whistleblowers themselves. And so there's a certain kind of pipelining issue that we need to deal with. On the other end of it, and this is coming to what Arturo and others have said, the security side. One of the things that people have been doing a lot, especially after Edward Snowden's revelations, is pointing out, you know, that we need encryption to apply to everybody equally. Now, we have to understand that when we have a society where there's a couple of whistleblowers, and everybody in society is under surveillance always, then the ability of whistleblowers or anybody else to maneuver and do things which might not be in the happy realm of what the government likes us to do is going to be caught in one of the pattern filters at one point or another. So that means that we could ask, you know, we could make the demand, which people have been making, that these surveillance programs be shut down. Now, the fact is that that's never going to happen. And even if it were going to happen, there would be no way for the US government or any other government to actually prove that it had happened, meaning that we can never, ever trust them again. There's no way they can ever regain our trust at this point. So our alternatives come in two forms. There's a short term, which is we need everybody to encrypt everything, not just whistleblowers sometimes, but everything must always be encrypted from everybody. Secondly, we need to get rid of these governments and replace them with something democratic.
So we talk about a lot of subjects, but if you're saying about whistleblowers, as Thomas Rick said, like deciding to be a whistleblower, like meant to him, like be excluded from the system, he get out of the system. It means that a system which excludes whistleblowers, there's something wrong, as Arturo said. So I think the way to fix the system is changing social behavior, because in the end, both politicians, they are there because someone voted on them. Corporations are there because there are people because of consumption behaviors of people. So we need a way to change social behavior in the end. And how we change that? With whistleblowing. So I think the solution for whistleblowers is to increase whistleblowing in the end. That's why, like, I'm always saying, like, we should stop with the centralization of whistleblowing. We should propagate whistleblowing as more as we can, in a way to put whistleblowers in a safer place.
Yeah. So I would like to ask Julia Dreyfus, because you have done something with a whistleblowing survey.
Yeah.
And I guess this is relevant to what has just been discussed. So could you tell us the outcome?
So a couple of bits and pieces, a couple of responses to what people have said. But yes, I encourage you all to participate in the survey. It's in 10 languages online. It's whistleblowingsurvey.org. It'll take you about 15 minutes. And we'd really appreciate as many participants. Doesn't matter whether you're a whistleblower or not, it's judging public attitudes to whistleblowing. So so you can ignore everything that I'm going to say and spend your time on the survey if you'd prefer for the next few minutes. We'd be grateful. It was very interesting actually setting the survey up. There were some very technically expert people who we turned to because we were quite concerned that people who would participate in the survey should be as anonymous as possible. And warning people to not put details in the survey doesn't always answer that problem. And of course, we can encourage people to use anonymizing technologies such as Tor, but a lot of people don't have those skills, which is actually leading into a point that I want to make. As part of the research project that we've done, the survey is one element, but there's also been gathering qualitative data, and that's been in-depth interviews with both whistleblowers and investigative journalists covering 11 countries who interact with those whistleblowers. And one of the things that we found in the research is that investigative journalists have been increasingly finding that it's very hard to get sources, particularly in government, to give them information. And that is the direct result of an international clampdown and heavy-handed approach in how governments treat whistleblowers. And that's, of course, bad for the public because they get less information. The other thing that I thought was an interesting trend from it was that journalists, really savvy journalists, in this area were not relying on electronic communications at all. So it didn't matter whether you could use GPG or even Tor, other forms of communication. They did not want, or their sources did not want any footprint whatsoever. And so literally some of these journalists were ripping things out of old John le Carre novels and leaving X's in chalk on post boxes on the third day of the month. And but that was the only way that they could assure that their sources of that type wouldn't be exposed. I think one reason that that's particularly important for the journalists to know as well is because our research also suggests that there are different types of whistleblowers. One type of whistleblower is very savvy, will spend some months thinking about who they're going to approach, if they're going to go external to the organization, and will do so very carefully. Another category of whistleblower is perhaps less savvy, and in fact, one former whistleblower who has a quite detailed knowledge for professional reasons of autism made the passing observation in these detailed interviews that that in their view, this particular category of whistleblower had a little bit of the tendency towards Asperger characteristics, in that the organization said to them, if you see wrongdoing, what you should do is tell someone about it and it will be fixed. And so they say, oh, I saw someone doing something wrong. They've missed the social cues that said, what we say and what we do are two different things. And if you actually go and tell someone about the wrong, we will skewer you. So instead, they've gone, but why isn't the wrongdoing getting fixed? Why am I suddenly being investigated? And all of a sudden, they had no idea that this tsunami was racing towards them in the form of the organization. They were about to be frog marched out the door by security on some trumped up charge that, you know, isn't reality. So that's what journalists have to face, including online whistleblowing sites, when they're thinking about and framing, you know, what they need to do to support whistleblowers. The last thing I would say is that technology has a critical role to play, not only in the avant-garde of protecting whistleblowers, both their privacy and their anonymity, which are two separate things, so the privacy of the information and the anonymity of the whistleblower. It has a very important role to play in acting as an amplification of change. So the research we have shows very clearly there is strong public support across a set of countries for whistleblowers and whistleblowing. Okay, that's what the public wants. They want them to be able to whistleblow safely, and they want them to be able to go to the media. And we're talking about not argy-bargy numbers of 51 or 52%. We're talking about 87% of populations that we've surveyed. Huge numbers. But the only way that that gets translated into laws and regulations is if people actually use the technology to put pressure on decision makers to change that and to call them to account. And I can think of no audience more apt to say this to encourage people to consider the ways in which they can contribute in their technical skills to doing this than this audience. So that's kind of the last thing I'd add. There was one last thing, which is that there is a role to play for increased analysis. So I think it's one of the arguments that hasn't been fully explored is, are we at a point of security saturation? And by that I define it as being where if you spend one more dollar on the security industry, you might as well take a match to it and burn it, because that's the benefit you give to your economy. And I would suggest that a reasonable hypothesis is we are well over security saturation, which means that a lot of the money that is being spent chasing ghosts could be spent on roads and bridges and public transport and public housing and schools and hospitals and all the things that populations actually really value and care about. But that economic analysis has yet to be done in a detailed way and then yet to be amplified using technology in a way that gets the message to the decision makers.
All right, excellent. So you can hold the microphone. And I would like to ask the audience if they have any comments for the panel yet. All right, in the back. I'm coming.
I look at this panel and I see all people who are white, pretty much. And what I don't see a lot of is the sort of public narrative and discussion around whistleblowing in places like India or China. I was just wondering if anybody wanted to speak to that.
Well, I can say a bit about India. I mean, I don't have a very deep understanding of it, but there are definitely a few cases of quite interesting whistleblowing initiatives in India, especially sort of grassroots driven ones. An example is I Paid a Bribe, which is this site that was born initially in India, and it basically allowed people to just go there and report, hey, I paid €50 bribe to get a passport, or I crossed this security check and I gave this money to this dude and, you know, didn't get any receipt or anything. And so it was like petty, like small scale corruption. And in this case, I mean, it gained a lot of media attention. It got very big, and eventually it started getting applied also to other countries, especially in the African region. And yeah, I think this is an interesting initiative. However, it's clearly something that is not as effective as a properly conducted whistleblowing initiative that has some concrete goals in mind and is targeted perhaps towards larger scale corruption and bigger issues. And we are in the process of working with some organizations there to start an initiative to deal with sort of larger scale corruption and issues that have to do, like a prime example of this is in India in 2008, I think, was uncovered a big scandal that had to do with the allocation of some funding to do with coal mining, and apparently there was fixed, and eventually the people that ended up getting much more money than was actually required, and it actually came out because of a whistleblower. Somebody went to a newspaper in India and gave them these documents that showed the family relationships between these people that were the people that eventually ended up getting the money. And it was a big scandal, and a lot of people got, are currently getting investigated, and it's still ongoing. But this is sort of the thing that you can try and contrast and stop with whistleblowing. But I don't know much about China. I believe that there it is much more dark.
So one of the things that, the last several years have been marked with a lot of whistleblowing from the Anglosphere, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that there isn't whistleblowing going on elsewhere. On the other hand, there is a certain element to it which some of the people who are legitimizing some of the terrible things that are being done to American whistleblowers have tried to point out, is that there's a certain aspect of the countries being somewhat liberal that allows whistleblowing to occur in the first place. Now, I'm not going to claim that the US is in any way liberal or reasonable in any way. They are absolutely not. But it can be said that the Chinese government, for instance, or various other governments around the world are substantially less tolerant of this kind of thing. And that means that the public, potential whistleblowers are going to be even more afraid. So, maybe we're just not getting all of the story, and maybe the stories just aren't coming out. Both of these are I think, reasonable explanations.
So, I think the issue, especially in China, for example, is that how would you perform digital whistleblowing in a so restricted internet environment, for example? So I think pretty much that in those countries, like you can say the country like which has this kind of freedoms like less developed, it's pretty much like a multidisciplinary struggle of civil society, like hacking communities, media, and people in general. So I think first, if you talk about digital whistleblowing in these zones, like we have to talk about other types of fights before, and that's interesting to notice, because when we talk about digital whistleblowing here, we are talking about something that cannot be performed in the whole planet, something that is mostly for European societies and North American societies, and it's very interesting to detect this issue. And think about it.
I mentioned this at my talk the other day on public attitudes to whistleblowing, but one of the interesting things we found in our survey was that we had very low participation rates in some languages, and one reason we've kept it open is to try and increase those participation rates. But while we were frustrated as to why people wouldn't fill in an anonymous innocent whistleblowing survey, attitudes to whistleblowing, we had serendipitous impact in other ways. And that was, for example, with the copy of the survey that's translated into Kyrgyz, which I didn't realize, but in Kyrgyzstan, whistleblowing is not really part of the culture historically. I'm not an expert in Kyrgyzstan, that's probably why, although there is a lot of corruption. But it turns out that the survey actually triggered discussion on radio. So although we were getting no actual people to fill in the survey, all of a sudden the radio, the tabloid newspapers, they're very interested in this. They wanted to run copy of it. They wanted to talk about it. And so it ended up being a way of raising awareness about whistleblowing without actually accomplishing all the things that we have to do as academics in gathering surveys. What does that tell you? That there is actually not necessarily a whistleblowing culture in a lot of cultures, particularly non-Western cultures. And, you know, this is true in a lot of places, for example, Bhutan, which has an anti-corruption organization, really is fighting an uphill battle in terms of the fact that it's very taboo to break ranks and not at all part of their culture. So this is a battle that has to be dealt with as a cross-cultural problem, as well as the more sort of forthright issues that we see in Western countries of governments just being recalcitrant in refusing to actually support people who reveal serious wrongdoing.
So I'd like to ask a question about sort of the ecology of whistleblowing. We're in a position now where if we acted on the material which has already been released by whistleblowers within the last 10 or 15 years, it would have to completely change the way that we operate our societies. Like, really fundamental stuff has been revealed. What can we do to make whistleblowing more effective after the stuff has been released? What are the next steps so that we get maximum bang per buck for every new thing which is released, with all the sort of secondary impact of making it more likely even more will be released? What's the missing magic?
I mean, there are two sides of it. One is taking the information and the people who know that information and can try to make an internal change. That's important, but that's often hard because you have these calcified bureaucracies that are so set in their ways that even when you're proven right, it's still up to the wrongdoer to make the correction. But something concrete you can do is protect the whistleblower against retaliation, because always retaliation. Always. I'm trying to think of a case where it did not happen. I can think of none out of hundreds. Always whistleblowers suffer severe retaliation, and it has been critical to have signatures from people, to have people doing petitions on change.org, to have public support, to have people writing articles about this, people who actually bother to be investigative journalists and government watchdogs rather than lapdogs. You can definitely do things to help the whistleblower. One of the most helpful things was someone took the information that I produced, and they were able to find, there was a key document when I blew the whistle in terms of prosecutorial misconduct involving the American Taliban. And one of the documents said, it was right after 9/11, and it said, "Don't be gentle with him, take the gloves off." Now that phrase, "take the gloves off," someone started investigating. And actually, there was a lot of that expression being written across different agencies after 9/11 by very high-level people. So that was really fascinating, but also helpful to me in terms of validating my case, and in terms of ultimately when the torture memos started to leak out, thanks to whistleblowers, again, it's run with that, with the media. Make it go viral. Help when there's a disclosure, that it not be buried in all the negativity from the government, all the character assassination and pathologizing of whistleblowers. You can help combat that by taking that information and running with it and seeing if you can dig down and find something more and sharing it and trying to protect this person. There's much more capacity to do that.
Yeah, I also think that it the answer to that question depends greatly on the kind of whistleblower you have, or what kind of case you're dealing with, because it's also to be said that not every leak or whistleblower has to do with terabytes and terabytes of data or tons of documents. It's generally something very specific and circumscribed, like somebody that sees some wrongdoing, knows very well what is happening, and it is that specific issue that they want to tackle with, and perhaps the best way to deal with that is not even to make it public. It's just inform higher management that that thing is happening and fire that person. That could be some. So it's not always just about the media, about reaching impact in public opinion, etc. It's also just about simple things that if you have oversight and transparency, you can spot and fix easily, and that is definitely part of it.
Part of the critical issue, again, in whistleblowing, is once you blow the whistle, you either have done it right after you left the system or you do it from within the system. You're persona non grata, you're radioactive. And so what's crucial is that that information must be crowdsourced in terms of social media. One of the fundamental things that I was at the very end of the line in terms of whistleblowing, where I ultimately went to a reporter. Remember, the government spent many, many years investigating me. It wasn't until years later that I actually became public. One of the advantages Edward Snowden is he disclosed himself, having escaped the U.S., to say who he was. So it immediately puts it on the radar, and then once it's on the radar, there's all kinds of mechanisms, speaking of digital whistleblowing, that allows us to amplify that, to megaphone it on a far grander scale than it's ever possible through traditional means. And this now, you're involving far more than just traditional journalism, traditional reporting, you're actually involving the populace, you're actually involving citizens. And now it's back, do the citizens care enough about what's been disclosed or exposed regarding the activities of a corporation or the government sufficient enough to take action, and now being pressure, calling up the respective media outlets, going to their representatives in government saying, hey, what the heck's going on here? This isn't right. That amplifies the voice of the whistleblower. Otherwise, it's just a voice in the wilderness. This way, it's no longer in the wilderness. You're actually playing it out on Main Street in the commons. And it has a far broader, far more impactful message.
We have another question.
Could I just add to that? Decentralizing the message, making sure that where the whistleblower and the documents or the information provided is being processed is contextually relevant. That is to say, documents from, say, Mali being published in the UK press won't really help very much with the public opinion in Mali. So we need to be very context specific.
Yeah, I would say something similar regarding that. But there are three points. I'll try to be quick. Which is first, whistleblowing platforms must have a relation with a certain community, with a certain context. No, so like a local leak or a local revelation, for example, if you talk about having social changes, it's pretty much stronger than an international and global leak. After, we need a better practice regarding maintaining the information there. Like, so we like a really enforce, for example, torrents, like information must be there. And that is really an issue. Also building this more decentralized and peer-to-peer storage of those files. After, there is also this problem. Like, we see now like a new kind of journalism that is boring and is yet up to be created, up to be coined, which is like people who is analyzing originally classified documents. So they have to dig, like in general, huge dumps, produce news using this material with the aim of producing social change. And that's, well, I don't know, maybe it's not even a journalism, maybe it's pirate journalism, like I talked to you yesterday, but it's something that is yet to be created, and that's also an issue.
I think if you talk about making whistleblowing successful, you need to keep in mind that 95% of whistleblowings happening internally first.
Yeah.
So that means within an organization. So to make it successful, you need to work with the organization. So you need to have solidarity between colleagues so that the whistleblower isn't standing alone, and you need to ask for a good culture in the organization. And I think everybody could do something there. And most of this whistleblowing is happening openly. So it's not about digital data and anonymous platforms. And I think there is also danger with these anonymous platforms. One is that normally people, I want to live at least in a culture where people raise issues see them, and they don't just assemble documents and send them somewhere. That's the one problem, that there's some kind of anti-cultural effect there. And the other thing is that all these platforms and everything dealing with media is on the attention market. So you need to win on the attention market. You need your case to be big enough, to be attractive enough, to be connected enough to cases which are already there, so that people understand it. It shouldn't be too detailed, shouldn't be too many documents, because otherwise nobody would dig into them. So there are a lot of conditions. So I think we should really look on both sides, look on these very big whistleblowing issues, cases which make whistleblowing prominent, which are enormously important, and their national security is a very big issue. But also look on the very small whistleblowing cases of the colleague beside you. So how do you react on that? And there we see as well the factor that the one who is addressee of the whistleblowing, so to whom the message is posed, he's also in a difficult situation very frequently, because he may not be in the position to affect the change himself. So he needs to convince people. He needs to stand for the whistleblower and build an alliance with him. And that's also a very critical position. And I think there's far too little research on this position of the addressee. Last remark concerning national security. I think we should talk about risk mathematics there as well. I mean, how many lives have been saved with per dollar spent on national security, and how many lives could be saved per dollar if you spend them otherwise?
So can I just jump in and say, for those of you who don't know, the person who was just making a very informed comment from the back of the room is Guido Strack. Guido runs what is possibly the most important whistleblower self-support network in Germany, and I think the site has helped more than, I don't know, 70 or 80 whistleblowers, and he has been a long-time protagonist for improvement to whistleblower laws in Germany. So he knows a great deal about which he speaks in terms of practical experience of what whistleblowers face. And the data actually bears out what he said. Most whistleblowers do go internally. In fact, there's some recent data out of the UK in the last month and a half that shows, I think it's something like 80-something percent more of whistleblowers try to blow the whistle at least twice internally before they will go externally. So that's a very common thing. Can I say most organizations are made up of good people and bad people? You know, there's been a fair bit of bashing of the security and intelligence agencies here and with some good basis. But there are also good people in these organizations, like every organization. Part of the role, I think, if you want to be a social change agent, is not just to put pressure from the outside. It's to provide tools and support for the good people who want to change it from the inside as well. The final thing I'd add on technology is a way you can really lend a hand, roll up your sleeves and help, is to help organizations like Guido's network, who may not have any technical expertise in how to improve their web presence, improve their ability to use technology to help and support at the coalface whistleblowers in what they do, because they often have no funding except what they're doing out of their own pockets.
Here's another question.
I want to know your opinion, but in my humble opinion, one of the most critical problems with whistleblowing are the journalists, since you can, create a specific email on a specific country, access the email only with Tor, from public places, take all the precautions you need to hide your identity, and then at the end the journalist asking you, it's very interesting, I like it, let's meet together since I have to validate the story. Why? If you meet me, you just see my body, nothing more. You can't have more information than the documents or many other things. But the journalists think that if you are a real person, also your information are reals. And that is not true. It's just a security problem, nothing more.
Uh, suggests that journalists vary. From the research data we have, journalists vary. Some journalists are quite happy to have long-term relationships with whistleblowing sources on an anonymous basis online and take the data that way as long as they can verify it externally. Then they have a trust relationship. They don't care who it is or what name you use. Alternatively, there are other seasoned journalists, 10, 20 years experience as investigative journalists, who say, no, that's not going to fly. If you want to be anonymous with me, I'm not going to publish anything you say. I want your name. And I want to know who you are, and I want to know what your motivations are. So you get either end of the spectrum. I would advise whistleblowers to shop around.
And I mean, this connects to what Guido was saying previously, and about the fact that it can be potentially even better to meet in person for security reasons, even because you leave much less traces. And if that is an option to both the journalist and the whistleblower, perhaps that is actually the ideal thing to do. Digital instruments can be useful as an introduction point. What happens after that depends greatly on the kind of case that you're dealing with, because it may require, I don't know, you to bring some physical thing that is really relevant to the story, and you know, you need to show it to the... I mean, people interact, the bandwidth that you use when communicating directly in person is much more than over the internet.
The paradox of all of this is that we have this amazing technology out there, but the more technology we have, the more I become backward and primitive in terms of being a lawyer. And I think it's true for a lot of journalists too. I always joke that I end up using drug dealer tactics. I meet my clients in person, I pay in cash, I have throwaway cell phones, and I do nothing important over the internet. And that's a really difficult way to be a lawyer in this day and age, but it's about protecting my client. And I think a lot of journalists may have the some of the same tendencies.
Can I read one? I wanted to read you one quote from one of the interviews that we did. It's from a whistleblower who could be described as having worked in the, let's call it, broader security area of government. And I read you this quote because I think it gives you a perspective into what the whistleblower lives, particularly the whistleblower who breaks rank from that sort of organization. They said, "I was offered to have my name changed and move states and go into a safe house. There's been a number of people who died in those safe houses. There was someone who put a plastic bag over their head and was supposed to have suffocated themselves. There was another who was supposed to have shot themselves in the head, but their arm wasn't long enough to reach the trigger. I knew I was dead. I could run and change my name, but I couldn't hide. These guys were going to kill me. So I hit the media. That's the only thing that kept me alive. You can't just blow the whistle and go off and have a nice day. It's something that affects your whole life. Like, I always stand to the right, like getting on the train this morning, I always stand back because there are a lot of people from this organization that are hurting and I don't want to get pushed in front of a train." And I can tell you, I know the background of this whistleblower, this is not absurd paranoia. This is absolutely legitimate concern.
Just wanted to underline that. Not until I began representing national security and intelligence whistleblowers have I had more than one client come in and tell me, "As a lawyer, you need to know I would never deliberately commit suicide." And I'm like, really? I'm like, seems overblown. But no, I mean, that's a fear right now, and particularly with our country and the United States willing to play prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner of any person on the planet, it's not an empty fear, even with the death of Michael Hastings, which seems...
So we need to make this one quick because we are really out of time. Okay, all right. Are you sure?
I'm really impressed and it's fantastic what you did, how courageous. But there's one thing I miss, and that is to give off a warning, not only to uncover things which are bad and evil, but I hear this whistle of this train in the night approaching. There's so much to come which we don't know yet. Shouldn't we look a little bit more in the future, what is still to come, and how? I feel as if it's in 1936, and the Nazis have already declared what they are going to do. How can we warn people what the other approaching things are after PRISM?
Could someone keep it short, like 1 minute?
That requires maximum exposure and disclosure as quickly as possible in the public commons. I'm the first to tell you, I spent many years blowing the whistle within the system, to all to no avail. And in fact, I was flagged immediately and followed and surveilled and retaliated against on a very significant level, to the extent that I haven't even revealed publicly, while I was within the system. I was marked already as a target. So you can imagine when you go public, what happens. And especially when everything you said is censored and silenced and no one's going to take action on it within the system, even though you are warning what's ahead. So the only other choice you have is to go public. Except if you go public, you're now even more exposed. And if I'm any case, as all the others are, it's criminal activity from the perspective of the surveillance and corporate state. So you have to have protection. And that's who do you trust? That becomes the fundamental question. Yeah, but remember, it's extremely dangerous in today's world to go public if you don't have proper protection or safeguards to ensure that even when you go public. There's a very interesting movie, if you've never seen it, called 3 Days of the Condor. At the very end, Redford is confronting the former head of the CIA unit, and he says they've got it. They've got it all. Well, who's to say they're going to print it? So there's other avenues. That's crucial in today's world, especially where we are right now at OHM 2013, to ensure those mechanisms are in place and that the individuals are properly protected and safeguarded, because it's extremely dangerous.
Yeah, I think, I mean, since you were talking specifically about PRISM and avoiding those kinds of mistakes, I think that at this point, I mean, the cat is out of the box. So everybody knows what is going on. It's no secret. Like, even if they try to hide it, I mean, there's no way this is going to be hidden from public. Everybody is talking about it everywhere, all over the world. It's on, the front pages of newspapers. Things that, we were talking about 4 years ago, telling everybody, yo, use Tor, they're spying you. And they told that we were like paranoid freaks. And now it turns out that we weren't actually so wrong, and perhaps we were actually even too reasonable, and it's actually even worse than we had ever imagined. And so what I think we need to be sure that happens is that people don't look at this and say, yes, I understand what is happening. This is the facts. This is what is happening. And they say, so what? Because I think that is the biggest threat and the thing that I am personally most scared about, that people will know and will choose to not care. And that is much different and a much, much bigger issue, because at that point, what will happen is that this will be normalized and it will be acceptable. And I think this is what we must stop.
I will tell you by virtue, the Dash 80 order, it's the Verizon order, which compels Verizon from a secret court to turn over all 100 million plus phone records, NSA, each and every day. The DNI, okay, under Clapper in the United States, simply talk about holding up the middle digital finger to the world. We've renewed the order 90 days later. Who's going to stop us? It's the catch 22. Who's going to stop us? We have the power. So yes, the cat's out of the bag. Okay, who cares? Our cat's pretty tough. What are you going to do about it? That's what they're doing now. It doesn't matter that the secret is out. We still have the power over you. So now that's where you've got to push back. Because if you're cynical and jaded and don't take any action, guess what?
We need to stop this because we're over time. I would like to thank all the panelists. Please give them a big round of applause.